loves to watch Christmas.
Hello, and welcome to episode 7 of If This Is a Podcast, Then What's Christmas? This is my second conversation with Dave Dye. The first one was episode 1 of the podcast, so if you want to go back and check that one out. Episode 1 covered about 1985 to 1993 or 4 or something. I'm not sure exactly what year Dave joined Liga Stellani, but this picks up exactly where episode 1 left off in terms of chronology. I think the general idea initially was to, you know, cover Dave's entire career in an hour, which we obviously didn't do. And then for this episode, I thought we'd at least get maybe two agencies in, maybe Liga Stellani and then Dave's next place, BNP. And we do mention the point at which that happened, but actually we got into so many interesting stories about the Liga Stellani years and the pieces of work that were done there, that we still took an hour just over that agency alone. So I don't know how many episodes Dave's entire career is going to become. If I was a betting person, I'd go for 6, maybe 7. Let's see. Whichever way it turns out, this is episode 2, the Liga Stellani years. So much great stuff in this one. Thanks so much, Dave. And without further ado, let's get on with our chat. Hi, Dave. Good to speak to you again. Thanks for making the time.
My pleasure.
Thanks. So when we last talked, if we're just going to follow the kind of chronological order where we were, you were just about to join Liga Stellani, or you'd insisted Tim Delaney had written you a note saying you were going to officially join, and I think that's where we were.
Okay. So, yeah, so I kind of made him write that on a piece of paper, which he laughed at, but wrote a piece of paper. So, yeah, I went back to Simon Palmer and resigned. So this is like about a week or so after Chris and Mark were kicked out. So it was all a little bit controversial. I can't remember whether I mentioned the campaign story.
You did.
Okay. So, yeah, so I went to work at Liga Stellani with Tony, with the writer Tony Barry, who was going to come to back to Simon Palmer to work with me, which I was delighted to go to the Liga Stellani. I thought it was one of the best agencies at the time. They were winning tons of awards. It was known for being a very tough, hard-ass place. I mean, I guess Tim was known for being like that. So when we went there, straight from the beginning, Tony and I were very disciplined. You know, we'd get in at like 7:30, spend all day locked in our room till about 8, you know, just trying to knock out idea after idea after idea. The first brief we got given was on Porsche. It was a campaign for Porsche. So we thought, it's an amazing thing to do. All the previous work had won awards, so we were kind of really into it. First week, I think, come Friday, I think we had a week on it as well, which was a long time for Liga Stellani. Come Friday, we took our pile of ads in to Tim in the morning about 11 o'clock. There was a meeting supposed to be in the afternoon. And he went, and we had about 10 that we really liked. We had some that we thought there might be something in it, and there was probably a bit of fodder, but we had a lot of stuff. And he went through, taking one off the pile, putting it next to the pile, went through them, and said, okay, not sure we've got anything there. Leave it with me. Sorry?
I was just laughing. Sorry.
So he said, okay, leave that with me. I mean, I since realised that normally what would happen is he would take the one pile and split it into two, and that one of the piles was the good ads, and one of them was to be thrown in the bin. But this was just the one pile remained one pile, but in a different place. So he said, okay, leave it with me. And obviously, this is our first week. We've spent all week really working hard trying to do something on this to make a good start. And then from our little glass office, we watched him walk into the Marshall Brothers, chat to them, leave. He walked out. And then 2 hours later, we saw them go in with a pile that became two piles, not one. And then he picked up one of the piles and then went to the meeting. So we were absolutely horrified. You know, we'd spent all week bashing our brains out, and that sorted it out in 2 hours. I think probably in retrospect, that was a welcome to Liga Stellini rather than there was nothing in the pile. I just can't believe there would have been nothing in it. But, you know, it certainly was an interesting way to sort of be welcomed. You think, God, you really can't. It's tough, you know. And I think even out of that pile that the Marshals created, I think they got, you know, 4 or 5 ads bought, turned into spreads or posters or whatever it was. So that was week one, which was quite unsettling. You think, God, if working at full pelt, not being distracted, not going to lunch, getting in earlier and leaving later than I'd worked before, didn't produce one ad that got bought, this is going to be tough. But the more, you know, we kind of stuck to that routine. I think he was probably trying to make a point, to be honest. But we kind of stuck to that routine of just hammering away every day. And I think in that sort of very quiet, determined, you know, it's like that phrase where, I may have mentioned it before, where that creative director, I think it was Colin Millwood, said he could tell the people who were working really hard because they were just staring blankly out the window when he'd walked down the corridor. You know, we would be, you know, it would be slightly grim determination. You know, we'd try really hard, but it wasn't very knockabout fun. We were both so desperately to do something. And then gradually, as we went on, we started to make lots of work. You know, once you sort of understand the parameters at Liga Stellini and you kind of get the lie of the land, particularly at that point, they had lots of accounts. It was really fast turnaround. It was unusual ever to get a brief where you had a week. You know, most of them was, you know, sometimes on The Guardian, we would get given a brief sometimes at 6 and we had to present to the client at 7 because it was a newspaper, it was fast turnaround. But I used to quite like that because I think, in a way, it was almost like no pressure. You think, well, we've got an hour, an hour and a half.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost like not having pressure. You think, well, I'll do my best, you know. I can't guarantee anything if you're going to give me an hour. But consequently, the upside would be, you think, well, if we show them in an hour or an hour and a half, they've got no time to reject anything. So whatever we give them, they've got like one of them. You know, so if we could get a few ads to present that we really like, we've got a really good chance of getting work through. And I think they had quite a lot of business like that at the time that was very, very quick turnaround. The upside for me as an art director was that the majority of work had to be made for no money, no time. So it really meant you had to focus on typography, colours, layouts. You had to learn how to use stock shots, you know, how to crop them, how to get the most out of these things. Because, you know, it wasn't the kind of agency like BBH or Collett's where, you know, you may get, you know, a scamp approved and then get 6 weeks to make it and figure out who the photographer was and then 2 weeks to retouch it. And, you know, these things were coming up, going out the door really quickly. And I think when you think of lots of work from that period that Liga Stellini did or before that period, that Tim had done with Steve, essentially that was all made from stock shots and nice design. There's very few ideas that were, you know, that would have started as a scamp and it would have been shot with Steve or something, art directing and arranging at the time. It was much more, let's get the images in, let's kind of organise the look of it, let's get it out, move on to the next one. So from that point of view, it was really good. It was a really good grounding in trying to understand, you know, it allowed me to create loads of ads, which may be a bit less precious and allow me to try stuff. I had minimum resources, which again made me probably push the design a bit more. You think if you just got a stock shot of, you know, say Terry Venables, we did one with Terry Venables on Adidas. You've got to look at what do you do with that slightly boring stock shot of a chubby-faced Terry Venables, and you've got your headline. And I think that would push you into using graphics. And I think because it comes straight from Simon's Palmer, I picked up a lot of stuff from Mark, although it was quite a short period. You know, Nike was to some degree like that. You know, they were all stock shots and found imagery. It wasn't huge budgets. So I guess initially I sort of tried to bring a bit of that Simon's Palmery edge to it, I think, in the first bit when I was there, rather than doing that sort of very upmarket posh stuff that they were known for. So yeah, it was good. I mean, I think within a year we'd made a mountain of work, a few commercials, tons of posters and press ads and all sorts of stuff. But I think ultimately Tony got frustrated because we were very optimistic about how we would do at the awards because we had such a lot of work, and we didn't do barely anything. I don't even know whether we got anything, or we may have got one or two things, but we were surprised and disappointed. And we had certain things. We had one of our favourites was for Adidas Streetball, promoting that around London. And we had these semi-blank posters with hoops that we put on at the right size. And it said something like Adidas Streetball Challenge, get practicing. And these were put in all areas of London. And there was all reports coming back that the people from the local pub had started playing there, and the kids from this estate were using that one. And so it was a really neat thing. And we thought, that's quite unusual, you know, a hoop on a poster, it's all set up, because obviously the poster is completely blank, so it's good to bounce the ball off it, which I think got nothing. You know, we had all these things that we were optimistic about. And I think because we'd worked so hard and we were sort of so optimistic, it was a bit of a letdown, and we ended up splitting up. I think Tony went to maybe M&C. I'm trying to think where he went, but we'd had about a good year, 18 months. I then worked with a lovely writer called Will Audrey from BBH,
yep.
Who wasn't really used to the Leagueist way. He'd been at BBH for 10 years plus, and I think he'd kind of been drafted in to sort of bring a bit of BBH-ness and a slightly different way of working, this very hand-to-mouth, quick, speedy turnaround stuff. But, you know, like lots of people who went there, once you join, you kind of get thrown into the swim of it and you just have to sort of survive. You know, you can't really change it much. And it's tough being head of copy when your boss is Tim Delaney. It's a tough role. So again, I think I worked with Will for about a year. Did quite a lot of stuff, started to work on Adidas a lot more. We had that as a global account. And again, we made quite a lot of work. I think it wasn't the right place for Will. It was a too big a change, really, I think, for Will. I then spent a little bit of time with Dave Hyatt, who people may know as the guy who started Howie's or the Do Lectures or Hyatt Denim. And he was very much into working on Adidas. He was really into sort of the whole sports scene and the sportswear scene. So, yeah, I worked with Dave. And at that point, he said he's thinking of starting a T-shirt company. He was sort of very much into the business side of it and had written a few slogans, for want of a better word. He had a business partner. And then he said, do you want to come on board as a sort of design partner? Which I did. We did a few early T-shirts. Essentially, they're all Adidas ads that had been rejected, frankly. So there was one that I'd done that said that I'd always really liked, but that just could never get it accepted by Adidas. You know, I kept submitting it for either running or any sport that would come up, and it which said life, and it was an asterisk. And it said for a limited period only. So we mocked that up as a T-shirt. We mocked a few others up as a T-shirt. 6 weeks in, 2 months in or something, I realised that he would sneak out of the office to go to BMX events. And I thought, well, I can't really do that. You know, I quite like advertising. I don't really want to sneak out going to these BMX events. I didn't really understand how into it Dave was at the time. So I sort of dropped out of that. And he went on to that, ended up turning into Howard's, which was a great brand. Sort of ripped off by Innocent, really. Innocent stole lots of stuff from them. So I did that for maybe 6 months. I was with Dave. Worked on my own for a period while a new writer was sought for me. Did some work with Tim. I did probably the first stuff I did was the running campaign with Tim. And I did a few ads on my own. I did one of them on the running campaign was for slightly broke out of what Tim and I had done, which was the red ad that said, just to the lamppost, just to the next bus stop, whatever it is, just to the next sign, which initially was rejected. I had a sort of scruffy old gruff of it. I was just thinking, what the hell the idea behind the whole campaign was to show that we understood the sports people. So unlike Nike, all the flashy stuff that Nike was doing that was all a bit glitzy and flashy and arrogant, although great, the idea of Tim's was to say, let's just connect with the athletes. Let's just show that we know what they go through. You know, we understand the sweat and the pain and the, you know, the drama that goes into it. It's not all big and bombastic. So the whole point when we run something like running was to think, how do we come up with an observation that shows that we get them? And the thinking being, rather than talking about the rubber of the shoes or it's this particular rubber on the soles, if you say we really get what you go through and you make an emotional connection, you might trust that their shoes are good too because they get what you're about. So anyway, so one of the things that I was doing, it's, you know, it's tricky when you think, so what happens when you run? Your arms are going up and down, you're bouncing along on your feet, you're getting tired, you sweat. There's not a tremendous amount to draw from. And one of the things I remembered is going running with Mike McKenna. We used to run around Regent's Park when we were at Publicis. Is just by the end, we were wrecked, saying, well, let's stop when we get to that gate. And then you get there and you think, oh, sorry, well, let's stop when we get to the bin. And then you get to the bin and you think, well, let's give it to that lamppost, and then that's definitely the end. We just claw our way around that last bit because we were so wrecked. So I kind of remembered that bit and thought, well, that seems like it's the only thing I could think of that seemed interesting. You know, your arms going up and down didn't seem great. Sweating didn't seem that good an insight. Whereas I thought, well, that's quite interesting. Other people must do that. Anyway, I kind of presented that as a scribble and I got a sort of, no, I don't think people do that. And I thought, well, you know, maybe he's right. I don't know. The problem with these sort of, when you write things from your own life, is you don't really know. You think, well, I do it. I've got no evidence anyone else does it. Anyway, so I kind of come out with probably a bunch of one pile again. And I thought, well, that one, I think other people must do that. There must be other people who get tired. Sounds silly in retrospect, but who get tired and say, well, let's stop there. And then they change their mind and they just do that. Surely other people must do that. So I showed a few other people in the department, like Tony Davidson and whoever was kicking around, probably Sean, who I wasn't working at the time. And they went, oh, yeah, I do that. They didn't say like, oh, yeah, that's really good. They just said, yeah, yeah, I do that. I do that. Where you say you're going to stop, but you just go on a bit further when you get there. So anyway, I thought, well, I don't understand why Tim doesn't accept that happens. You know, he's ancient, this guy. He's in his 40s. What does he know? So I mocked it up. You know, the one of the upsides of Liga Stellini and the way that they did things is instead of, as I was discussing before, with like the Colletts way, which would be perhaps you get four ads approved and then you get four shots, bespoke shots with everything in the place of the layout. What Liga Stellini would do at the time is they would get someone like really good like the Douglas brothers, give them a few pairs of running shoes and say, right, go to Spain or America for a week, shoot the shit out of someone running up and down different places, make it look good and send us back in the pictures. So at Liga Stellini, we'd have drawers full of amazing pictures that the Douglas brothers had done of people running that weren't for specific ads or specific layouts. They were just interesting stuff who wanted to use it. So I went down to one of the drawers, found the nearest thing I could to something that would work for my idea of just running down the street and just preparing to stop. And there was something that wasn't ideal, but it was a kind of street. So I mocked it up. I thought, all right, I'm going to show it again to Tim, not in such a scruffy format. I'll mock it up. And I kind of got a bit wound up because I thought, well, I'm supposed to be head of art. If he's not going to trust me, and I run, if he's not going to trust me on something like this, it's pointless, you know. So I kind of went in all ready for a fight and thought, for some reason, I thought, well, if he doesn't buy this, I might as well leave. If he's not going to trust me on something that I do, you know, four times a week on this observation, I've mocked it up, it looks nice. So I kind of went in, queued up, he'd always have a queue, went in all ready for a fight, you know, when you've really psyched yourself up, all ready for this thing. So I was queuing up to see Tim, really hyped up, you know, potentially I'm going to resign over this. This is like, you know, for whatever silly reason. Because I wouldn't really get that wound up that often. I'd think, well, it's his place, you know, I might not agree with all his decisions, but if I disagree with too many, I should go somewhere else, you know. So anyway, I got myself all hyped up, went into him, and he's a smart bloke, so he could tell that I wasn't my usual self, and he said, what's up? So I said, it's about this ad that you rejected last week. He said, all right. I said, I think we should do it. I think it's good. We're already teeing up for the kickoff. And he went, okay. Which was incredibly frustrating because obviously he'd thought, you know, he's been dealing with people for years and he's read the situation and thought, he's all hyped up, bless him. Let's just let it go. So he said, yeah, all right then. So I kind of came out more wound up because that all, you know, once your adrenaline's going and you're ready.
Yeah.
You're kind of frustrated, but anyway, so that ended up running, and it did really well. And I think it was a good lesson to me, if anything, for just using a piece of your own life, you know, because obviously you particularly when you start, you look to the awards books for, you don't try and copy per se, but you think, well, that's obviously the good stuff. I want to win awards and do good stuff, quote marks, whatever that is. So that's your guide. And I guess that was one of the first kind of things where I didn't really have a guide. I thought, and I didn't really know how to put it together or anything. I just thought, I quite like that observation of running along and just clawing along. And then it did very well. So, so that was very helpful.
Can I just ask you from an art direction point of view, I believe you said in the art director's book, the DNAD one, a last minute red vignette saved it. I don't know if we're going to get in technical art direction things here, but can you explain that, please?
Yeah, basically, one of the problems was compared to the rest of the running campaign, which had three lines of copy running into it, and they'd all done very well. You know, we'd had about 8 or 10 running ads in the previous DNAD. And I thought, got it, for a start, it doesn't seem to work in that format, which I first mocked it up. Like, and so that felt like I was breaking with a winning formula to not have that copy. You know, it's three lines of text going into the three-line logo. So that, for a start, felt like a problem. I thought, I can't make it work within that layout. I'm going to have to abandon that. And that did really well for us. So I'm going to have to just follow the idea and you know, I'll use the same font and it will come out wherever it comes out, but I have to abandon the whole layout. So I put it together. All the previous running ads were in these sort of softy, pastely colours. They were like these sort of black and white lift prints with flat colour put over them. So I kind of did it in that sort of vein. And I thought, God, it just looks so sedate. Let's say it had a pale blue over it or whatever it was on this street thing. It just seemed so calm. I thought, it just doesn't look right. It just seems flat and calm. And I thought, somehow what I want to do is I want it to be hot and sweaty and, you know, it's as if it's from the viewpoint of the runner and he's about to collapse, not this sort of pale blue floating along vibe. So I used the brightest red I could use to try and make it look hot and sweaty. And then at the last minute, I thought, I wonder whether I could use, Mark Denton used to use vignettes quite a lot. And I thought, I wonder if I put like a really black edges all around the ad so that it focused your eye down the street, almost like it was from the viewpoint of the runner. So you sort of cut out all the extraneous stuff around the edge of the ad and just focused you down the street. And I think the combination of those two things added a huge amount. You know, the difference, obviously, I had the original roughs, because the difference is huge. You know, they're two smallish things. One is a change of colour and one is a sort of, you know, this little black vignette around the edge. But it really lifted it a lot.
And you also just said not only was Will Audrey head of copy in an agency where Tim Delaney existed, but you're talking about yourself as head of art agency where Steve Dunn was there.
He wasn't there when I was there. I was after him.
Oh, okay.
That would have been tricky. he'd gone. When I first went there, Martin Galton was there for a bit. I don't know how long he was there for. And he was the other end of the spectrum from Steve Dunn, in the sense that he was much more... He was sort of experimental. He wasn't interested in the niceties, which is a positive thing. He would experiment with stuff, and sometimes it would be look amazing, and sometimes it would look terrible. But he would, you know, I mean, he's the best example of that is in the art director's book, where he experimented with his spreads in the art direction book, and he shows no ads, a picture of a TV with Tommy Cooper on, some various bits and pieces, and he would approach things in that sort of way day to day, which is not really my way, but sometimes it gets really good results. But it was a very different, certainly very different from Steve, and probably different from me. And
so you didn't then really learn from Steve, I guess, then. So do you think like you picked up a lot from Tim, or what was shaping your art direction ability at that point?
Well, I mean, I've always been a bit geeky and sort of read about it and researched it, and I suppose that comes through on the blog now, but so I've always kind of looked into it. I think the biggest thing was just to being able to do so much of it. You know, I think at Simon's Palmer, you know, if you got one ad through a month or every 6 weeks, you'd be doing well. I think at Legas Delaney, sometimes you could get six ads through in a week on different things. And I think you have to pay attention and get to grips with it pretty quick, but also it allows you to try stuff, to not be, you know, if you're getting 10 ads through a year, you can't take as many chances as if you're getting 100 ads through a year, you know. So, you know, I was fantastically hungry and trying to, you know, once I realised what I had to do, and that I had to learn about fonts and I had to learn about how things were put together in more detail and how I could feed that into my own work. I would be absorbing as much as I can. So I'd be getting Rolling Stone magazine when Fred Woodward was the art director, which was amazing. And you'd sometimes pick up fonts and bits and pieces or photographers. I'd get Fabian Barron's, whatever he was doing at the time. It could be, what he would have been doing at the time, Harper's Bazaar probably. Could be before that, maybe Interview. So I'd be getting as much stuff as I could. I'd be getting the SPD editorial annuals, anything, any book that was in any way related to anything to do with communication, photography, graphics, anything, I would go and buy. And I could just see the correlation between knowing that stuff. And I often used to think, well, I'd get these things and then use it as reference and go to the studio and say, let's do it like that. But it never worked out like that. It's just that you would take in these things and they would come out in different ways. So, I guess that's like being self-taught to some degree. Although Mark was great when I was there.
Yeah, the department was full of, you know, amazing people who went on to have pretty incredible careers. Did you kind of feel like you were a sort of special department at that time, or was it just, you know, the way things were?
I think it looks more special in retrospect. I mean, it felt good, but it didn't. I think, as I said, in retrospect, it looks better than it was at the time. I mean, at the time, we had Tony and Kim, Paul and Nigel. You know, there was a lot of people there, and some of them were sort of just starting. And I think you know, it was good. Legas Delaney at the time was doing some nice stuff, was winning a lot of awards. You know, they would have the BBC globally, Adidas globally, had some big accounts, and it was good. It was a really good vibe. I mean, it was very tough, and it was a bit like being in the trenches, you know. I think Tim's system of sort of, you take your work in, and it was a bit like the headmaster, you know, he'd divide things in different piles or cross things out and tick things. But good learning, you know, it was really good learning. And I think, yeah, a lot of, you know, I think that sort of, I don't think there's anybody who would have come through that who wouldn't have benefited way, even if they didn't like it, you know.
Yeah. So I guess two more interesting things that happened. I don't know which order they come in, so maybe you want to talk about them in the right order, is the A Make Your Own B campaign for Adidas and teaming up with Sean.
Oh, yeah.
What happened first or second?
Well, first I teamed up with Sean, which, so he was very funny, quirky guy who was travelling from Leeds to London every day. So amazing. He was a bit of an anomaly there. So he would get in at perhaps 10, half 10, whereas everyone else was in very early. And then he would leave at like half 4. and nobody had really worked at Legas Delaney like that. It was weird. I think I'd recommended to Tim to get him in initially because Chris and Mark used to rave about Sean. And he was very, very idiosyncratic. You know, he's quirky. And we used to sort of get on quite well when we weren't working. And then I can't remember what happened, but somehow we ended up being put together. I think we might have done a few ads together when one of his partners was away or something. And that kind of worked really well. You know, I think you know, sometimes you work with people and it doesn't. Well, there's a combination of A, you're trying to beat each other's brains out and be the one who gets to the answer. And then B, you're also having a laugh. So it's like a sort of weird combination of being hard and tense, but also fun. So we did a lot of stuff together. I think basically what happened with the A Make Your Own B and there was another campaign we did which was for English Heritage as well, yeah. Is that unfortunately Tim's son got ill, and Tim, it's quite a serious situation, and Tim disappeared, and the MD, Bruce Haynes, said, we're not sure when Tim's coming back, could you stand in? So yeah, you know, it's weird, I've never been in that situation. So I sort of did that, and obviously you can't help but revert to type. So at the time, there were certain ads that I really liked that Tim had rejected, that the briefs would come round again. So, you know, with Tony and Kim, I'd say, oh, get out that ad. You know that ad that you had with the for kids basketball with the stepladder going up to the hoop? I think we could run that on a brief I've just seen that's coming in. Tricky, really, because they're all things that Tim would have, for whatever reason, not approved. But it's very difficult double-guessing someone. And I thought, well, I think that's great, that one. Or this, you know, so there'd be lots of bits and pieces that were more picture-based, probably, that had been rejected. So I, first of all, approved all of those. secondly, it's the first time that I'd ever had that thing where you kind of write an ad with one hand and then you approve it with a tick with the other hand. You think, well, this is a great system. You can write all your ads, yeah, and then just approve it. And I've never had that before. I thought, this is amazing. So I think I turned down a job at BNP a couple of months before, because it was going very well at Legas and I liked it. And they said, oh, you could be at BNP, you could be creative director on your own stuff. And I didn't really, I thought, yeah, whatever. It wasn't really. But once we started working in that way where you can write, I mean, it just seemed like a joke that you could write stuff and then at the end of writing it saying, yeah, it's approved. Let's show it to the client. It seems so bizarre when you've, you know, probably at that point I'd spent 10 years not doing that. And then out of that sort of stuff, I guess, in that little window, we did some work that was just what we wanted to do. You know, no one was marking it or pushing us in any direction. And ironically, I could be wrong, but I think the English Heritage was done in that period as well. And that was very much Tim's kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I suppose the A maker and B, I don't know. I mean, he's probably broader minded than people might imagine, but that was done in that period where we were sort of, you know, I was sort of in charge of it.
Did he feel an extra responsibility to, you know, because there isn't anyone like giving you a secondary perspective on your work to say, oh, well, maybe if you change this or that, or that there's that way or this way. Did you feel super responsible to make sure your work was of that standard just in case, if you know what I mean?
It's difficult to remember, to be honest, but I don't think so. I think, you know, we're obviously at this point, I've been doing it for about 10 years. And we were really into it, and we would be focused and trying really hard and have an opinion on what we thought was good. So I don't think it was all of a sudden thinking, oh, Jesus, is that good enough? Isn't it good enough? It was just all of a sudden you could pick your own stuff. And my memory of that is just that being great. So it wasn't more pressure or stressful. And obviously I couldn't really guess. I'd gone into it thinking, well, I need to make sure I pick ads that Tim would pick, I couldn't guess. You know, he's probably less predictable than people think. You know, he's smart, but I could only pick ads that I thought was right for me. You know, I'd read the brief and look at the things and think that seems like that might affect people.
Were you also having to do the other elements of his job, like distribute the briefs and manage the department in that way or not?
A bit of that, but I think it was, it wasn't overly structured. I mean, I'm trying to think of how many people are at the agency at the time. We probably would have had 8 teams, maybe. Maybe 70 or 80 people in the agency. So it wasn't huge, you know. There wouldn't have been lots of the other stuff. You know, there was one pitch that we did that I remember for Isabella Rossellini. But my main memory of it is just the joy of being able to pick ads that you thought were good. I don't remember any of the sort of admin-y aspects. And also, I'd never done anything like that before, so they probably wouldn't have, you know, throw me into too much, but more or less making sure the creative department ran okay. So two things happened after that, which is one, Tim came back and a meeting was organised with me and the, I'm trying to think what he would have been called, head of sort of production. And there were various things got together, some sort of UMATs for people of an age, you might know what a UMAT is, and proofs and chroma lens. So a big pile of work that had gone through when he was away. So we'd won a pitch, which I thought he'd be thrilled with, and lots of work had either been made that he'd approved or been made that he hadn't approved or gone through clients and hadn't been made anyway. So there was a big stack of this stuff, big volume of stuff. So we sit there and the creative production guy says, right, so, okay, this is the first one this is for Harrods thingy. So Tim looks at it, sort of closes his eyes, said, okay. what's the situation with this one then? Is it run? Yeah, that's run. So it's gone. This one's gone, is it? Yeah, that's gone. That's run. That's like, yeah, a while ago now. Right. That's okay. Right, that's gone then. That one has actually appeared. Yeah. Okay. Right. Okay. So next one. And this one's gone. This has happened. This is out there. Yeah. Fun. Yeah, that's right. That's gone. That one's gone too. Okay. We don't need to do this. We don't need to do this. It's fine. Okay. Right. Forget it. And that was it. That's the end of the season. it was too painful to go through, which you got to like in a way, you know. So this big stack of stuff that we'd all got together, you just couldn't go through it. It was just too painful to see all these ads and ideas that weren't really what he would have chosen.
But when you saw stuff like English Heritage and A Mate Your Own Beer, did you not go, at some point he saw it, obviously, did he not go, wow, that was really good?
I can't really remember. I mean, that, you know, the ones I remember at the top of the pile were Harrods ads. I don't know whether I don't know what stage the English Heritage or A Mate Your Own Beer, but, you know, not everybody, you know, views those as positive the first time they see him. I don't know. So he didn't seem, you know, it's tricky. He'd been away. It was a really difficult situation for him. And essentially he's come back to get to grips with it. There's a load of ads have run that he wouldn't have chosen on his beloved accounts. So, you know, part of me quite likes the fact that he cares about it that much. You know, it was a bit weird at the time. It made me feel a bit bad. You think, well, that's a shame. He doesn't seem to have liked my choices. But, and I think what he did is then he sort of re-established himself a bit and rejected a shitload of work from most of the teams, which, you know, which was tricky. You know, it was tricky for particularly me and Sean, because we'd got used to, you know, writing these ads, going approved, give it to the client, you know, give it to the account person. And then all of a sudden we're back to getting our work put into two piles or no piles and ticks and crosses. And that was a hard adjustment. And that basically led to a little shortly afterwards, BMP called again and said, look, let's have another chat. We'd like you to come in. And by that point, I thought, God, this whole creative director thing is great. You know, why would you not want to do that? You know. So we ended up leaving there. Me and Sean left there to go to BMP.
Can I just, before we go to BMP, stay at League of Slaney a little bit? Because A, Make Your Own B, there's a thing I think you wrote in the Art Director's Book again about last minute finding the handwriting of a bloke in the studio and using that. Yep. And also on English Heritage, Dave Wakefield hot press set the whole thing. Those are two very different typographical approaches. I wondered if you just wanted to talk about those two a little bit.
Yeah, I think the hardest bit for me, probably in terms of art direction, is what's the idea for the art direction? You know, and I think often when I'm overseeing stuff, people, for me, tend to move straight into the art direction straight away. So, you know, without really knowing, without a plan, it's just like, should it be blue? Should it be this? Should we use that font or this font? And generally for me, it's good to have an idea of what you're trying to achieve or what the tone is or understand the art. What is it about, what part of the idea you want to bring out, or some plan, you know. And I think with both of those, I had a plan, which was the trail running ads, the A Maker and B and Hurry and that those ads. We wanted the pictures to look beautiful, like you wanted to be there. And we talked to three photographers. One was Joel Meyerowitz, who's an amazing photographer, who I really wanted to give it to because he'd done amazing work. He'd done some great Nike stuff and all sorts of other great stuff. Someone I didn't really know very well at the time called Sally Gall, who was a sort of art photographer who the art buyer was sort of pushing. I can't remember who the third was. And Sally Gall had written pages and pages of text on how the shot should be. Now, there was only three. And they came through on a fax in the days when faxes were kicking around. And I thought, God, she seems just so into it. I can't remember a word she said in retrospect, but I thought, I've got to give it to her. And she seems to be so into it, has such a plan and a clear view on what she thinks. Essentially, we're only taking pictures of, you know, little dirt tracks in mountains and, you know. So in the end, I sort of switched from Joel Meyerowitz to Sally Gore, this sort of art photographer to sort of capture the mood. I liked sort of the mood of things. You know, it seemed like misty morning. You know, there's some sort of vibe about her pictures that seemed a bit zen and whatever. Having got those pictures, I didn't want the ads to feel too much like ads or too formal. I wanted them to be a bit more, it's all about the outdoors and natural and stuff. So I wanted it to not be very formal. So fonts seem to make it very formal when you use fonts. And I quite like the idea of handwriting, but the problem is there's like a billion types of handwriting and what sort. You don't want it too graffiti-ish, and you don't want it too like you've learnt to write like that at school. You know, it was sort of tricky. I found it really difficult to find the sort of handwriting that I wanted, which was a bit scruffy, but not like any of the dodgy handwriting fonts that you get on the Mac. Anyway, I kept trying different things. I was trying battered types and different handwritings of people, and it all looked contrived. I suppose all of it seemed contrived. And then I found some handwriting in the studio of a guy called Graham Wood, who was a typographer there for a bit. I didn't know it was his at the time. And he'd written some stuff. I don't know how he'd done it, but it looked really scruffy. So I tried that, and it seemed to really work. It was a really good contrast between these sort of slightly poetic pictures of nature and this scrawled on text. So we lifted the letters that we had, and we didn't have an A from memory, so we used an A that we found in a font and battered it up and twisted it and pulled it to try and get it to match. But and we just used his things that were kicking around. I can't remember what he'd written, something on an old Adidas ad. And it just seemed to really fit. It didn't feel like an ad. And I remember seeing them in The Guardian, and they looked great because it could have been a bit of editorial. It was just the idea. There was like there was so little on the page. A was big, make your own B was small. And then I battered up the little logo to look it like it was a bit hand-drawn or something. I can't remember, it was in the corner. But there was super minimal and looked a bit like sort of graffiti or editorial. And it worked really great. It worked out well. In terms of the other one, I guess that's the polar end of the opposite end of the spectrum, which was, since I'd been at Legas Delaney, I always used to like their long copy, intelligent looking ads, you know, the sophisticated and you know, like my favorite of those would be Ordnance Survey, which right. I think look amazing. Yeah. But they've got endless campaigns that would be long copy, and the theory is, you know, which is people don't have to read it all, but they'll just think, God, if you can write that much about a shoe, it must be really well made. Yeah. Or if you can write that much about whatever it is. So I'd always kind of wanted to do one of those sort of very Legas Delaney type things. And we pitched for English Heritage, and I mocked up in a sort of mock low-rent Legas Delaney way these ads that were long copy and had different stories around the edge of the headlines. And then I think we won it, and I thought, God, how do we make them look much better? And it may have been through talking to Tony and Kim, who used to work with Dave Wakefield, you know, who were big fans of his, or just me just seeing Dave Wakefield stuff that he'd done with Mark Reddy, like Abelauer and stuff. I thought, you know, there's only so far you can take these things on the Mac, particularly at that time. They always look a bit ersatz, you know. And I thought we need it to look, as it's English Heritage, we need it to look authentic. Not really like an ad in a sense, but like a, I can't remember what the reference would have been at the time, but sort of an old manuscript or an old authentic piece of English something or other. So I ended up getting Dave to do it, which again is sort of in retrospect slightly weird because we would have had a number of designers and typographers there. So to find the money to outsource it, to get someone like Dave to do it all in hot metal would have been tricky. But and then again, he, you know, if he then lifted them to a whole new level. I mean, the borders on them, I'd done some squiggly lines at the bottom of the ads and thought, and probably put an arrow saying, do some squirrely, nice bits of design stuff. And he come back and did some nice squirrely bits of design stuff, but it all meant something. You know, there's, it's difficult saying it on the phone right without the ads here, but there were like overhead diagrams of the, if you saw them, you just think squirrely, nicely designed bits of stuff. But then if you knew what they were, there would be overhead plan views of the castles to scale. One of them would be a border made out of Morse code things that actually said something relevant, can't remember what it was now. I mean, there, it was just a whole new level of craft that he brought to it for me anyway at that time. It was incredible. And then we tried to make each feel slightly different. So they all used completely different fonts and colours and everything, but they sort of felt like there's a sort of grid that makes them feel like a set. So I so enjoyed doing those. I mean, Dave was, he brought an enormous amount to that. But I guess in both of them, in terms of art direction, I sort of had a... So I guess with those, we tried to make each of them look made up. We tried to make the ingredients of each of them are completely different. They're all different fonts and different colours and different borders and different everything. But there's a sort of grid that holds them together that makes them feel similar. It was good doing those. I mean, Dave was he brought an enormous amount to that.
And did the client were they an easy sell? And did they take a very long time to make? I guess a couple of questions.
They took ages to make. When midway through making the fourth, we did three. Midway through making the fourth one, which said visit a castle your great 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 grandfather took your great 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 grandfather to as a child or something like that. In the copy we'd put, God, what was it? Either Her Highness or Her Majesty, but we'd use the wrong one according to the client, Jocelyn Stevens, who's I can't remember what it is. We'd refer to as a Her Majesty or Her Highness, and whatever we'd used, he said that was the wrong one, so he fired the agency midway through the fourth ad.
For that,
because wow. He was appalled. So he didn't really care about the level of craft that David brought to the table or the funny headlines we'd written. You know, it was like, oh no, we can't live with that sort of thing. And I still don't know which is the right one, but yeah. So we got fired midway through the campaign, which is a shame because you know we'd written quite a lot of them. That was that.
So the other, because I think predominantly you're known more for your print stuff than your TV, but at Ligas at that time you did the Prince Nassim TV ad with Sean and the Douglas brothers. Was that an easy thing? Did that go through Tim? How was that?
Did that go to a team in terms of what creating?
No, did it go through Tim? Tim went through Tim.
Yeah, I mean, we did it. I probably did about half a dozen Adidas commercials. I think, Liga Stellini was quite, you know, Tim had his way of doing things. And in some ways it would help you, like the example I gave when we did the running ad, and I could just go down and get a picture that was sort of near enough, and it ended up being the final thing. Sometimes on TV it wasn't ideal. So sometimes it would be, everybody would be briefed on Prince Nassim. He would pick the ad you picked, and if that got, you know, that got made, that was the usual system. Sometimes it would be, because it was a global account, everybody would get briefed on the replica shirt for Argentina was one of them. You'd all write in your scripts. If you wouldn't hear, you think, well, that's been has been rejected or something. And I remember we did exactly that on the Argentinian replica shirts, and I had to run in Argentina, pitched in some ideas. One of them was, at the time, me, Sean, and a few other people in the department all used to play keep you up with a football in the middle of the department and, you know, bet on it and stuff. Anyway, so we had this idea that we had the fans trying to do keep you up, but they were crap. You know, they're wearing their Argentinian shirts, and there was some line at the end about, I can't remember how we resolved this thing, but it was sort of the fans trying to do keep you up and being crap. And we thought it could be quite a funny little thing. Anyway, we forgot about it, and then someone from the TV department turned up one day with a UMAT. Said, "Oh, there's your film, by the way." So I said, "Oh, what's that?" They said, "The Argentinian film." So I said, "Which one?" And we put it in, and it was that film, but shot by the Douglas brothers. So instead of funny and people looking idiotic and silly, a lot of it was slow-mo with hair bouncing around, curly hair bouncing around in slow-mo. It just wasn't in any way funny, and we hadn't had anything to do with it. We were just given a UMAT. It had been done. So sometimes, the TV there was handled like that. That wasn't the norm, but it wasn't the only time that sort of thing happened. So, yeah, so that was probably done in a job lot. The Douglas brothers probably did four in a batch, and unfortunately one of them was a script that was just not appropriate for them at all,
I was just talking to Paul Burke actually last night and doing one of these chats with him, and obviously he's Mr. Radio and really leaned towards that as a medium. Did you find you preferred working in either TV or any kind of print, or did it feel like there was a different, more pleasant or less pleasant or easier or harder process to work in TV and print?
Well, I think, I started, we probably mentioned it before, that the first couple of years I was just doing TV. So I just, I was making quite a lot of commercials, not particularly any good, but I was just doing TV because I wasn't allowed to do anything printed because my layouts weren't neat enough. And then as I went on, as you get made head of art, you end up very much in the world of overseeing other people's stuff and trying to firefight and do that sort of stuff. I mean, it's a sort of different, obviously it's a very different process. I mean, I think the hardest medium for ideas is posters.
Yeah.
Because you've got just so little to work from, and generally it's quite useful now when these campaigns split out into, however many channels we've got now, 20 channels. If you can nail the posters, you can generally figure out how to how to spin it out in all channels, whereas I think if you nail the TV or the radio or even the digital, it sometimes doesn't spread across the other channels as effortlessly. Whereas I think if you make something work in a poster and you've got, whatever it may be, a single image and half a dozen words, generally it's a tighter core idea, I think. So, and I like the challenge. I like the challenge of trying to do that. That discipline. I guess also the other thing is with things like that, you have absolute control.
Yeah.
I think these sort of trusting and working with the other elements, whether that's directors, editors, can be tricky.
Yeah, I think it's funny actually, because I totally agree about the control thing. It's funny how you can put a good script into a process where all the elements you think are in the right place. Like you've got a really good director, and it's going through a good editing house and all those kind of things, and it still not turn out quite the way you wanted. And there's not that much you can do about it once it's come out that way. And I always found that a little bit annoying and frustrating, but I guess there are some people who like to sort of ride that wave and sort of go, I don't know what's going to be, and that's what I like about it. So maybe it's different kind of mindsets.
Well, it was interesting hearing Mark talk about the Tony Kaye experience on your last podcast, which was interesting. My memory of that, it was that initially they were horrified when Tony first showed the film. And it's interesting that even at that point, so Chris and Mark would have been one of the best TV teams in the country.
Yeah.
And they've given an idea, which I know what the idea was. The idea was passing from country to the pool. It was later done by Nike. The ball would be chipped by an English player. You cut to someone receiving it in Italy.
Yeah.
He pushes it on to someone, and it's someone in France. And it's a neat idea. It's a good idea.
Yeah.
So to go from that to no idea, effectively, to let Tony say, let's not do that idea, let's just do some footage, and we'll get a good track. So that happened to them at that point, it sounded like, from what Mark's saying, they had no option. You know, it was pointless trying to talk Tony out of it. He'd done a storyboard of what they wanted to see on a storyboard, but then didn't do it anyway. So there's that fact that they couldn't control that process, even at that point. It's their agency. They're one of the top teams in the country, if not the top team. And then the other thing, just to top it off, is it comes out amazingly, wins five pencils, and everybody loves it. If you had to draw that up as a storyboard, there's nothing there. You see some pictures of a net wobble, Ian Wright running up and down. I mean, there's no, you know, put that back into script format and it would make no sense at all. So I don't know what you learn from that. I mean, you could learn from, you have to go with your gut and trust people. But there's obviously, there'll be a lot of people who say, well, we trusted person X. He took away the idea and it was rubbish because there was no idea in it. It's tough to know what you learn from that. But
well, I'm sure it's a lot easier when you, well, I mean, it's more likely it's going to turn out brilliant if you've got Tony Kaye in his absolute prime, which is one
absolutely
of the best
things
you
helps
have.
Then, I guess maybe that's what you learn. If you've got someone in their prime, maybe you go with it. I don't know. I don't know. It would be interesting. I'd love to see what Tony shot from, I don't know when that started, from British Rail to, you know, for the next 10 years, to see whether there's 50 ads that are terrible amongst that, and they're the ones that just stood out, or whether, you know, whether they're, whether he didn't shoot much more than that. I wouldn't know his output well enough to know whether there was, whether that process sometimes ended up in terrible results or whether it was always a winner. I mean, it's interesting looking at, in retrospect, Frank Budgen's stuff, because you know that he didn't really turn out many things that weren't good. You know, I don't think he, yeah, I mean, most of it, every time he did an ad, it seemed to be pretty good. It wasn't, there wasn't lots of stuff. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. He seemed to plot it out and it always seemed to work.
Well, yeah, and when you know how much
my guess would be, Tony has got more experiments that didn't quite work.
Well, yeah, and now we don't know which of Tony's ads were the original script or not, whether it's the,
no, absolutely,
the cat kissing the dog or Twister even. And I'm hoping at some point to speak to Tom and or Walt and I can ask them about that, ideally. But, you know, Twister is a series of, you know, different images of that guy, you know, doing his stuff with a hurricane or whatever, with a Twister. And, you know, what of that was planned out? Was the barn dropping from the sky a planned shot? Was the piano dropping on unexpected a planned shot? You know, it'd be really fascinating to know that. So, we've got an hour again. And the reason I stopped there is because if I do too much longer, I can't fit the file on WordPress
into
the thing. And rather neatly, we've come to the end of one more
we've
agency.
Come to the end of, I mean, it's going to take a thousand
it's
years.
It's going to take a long time.
Where I am, but yeah, no, I'm happy to, whenever you want to chat.
I'm thinking that next time we'll cover BMP, I'm sure. Maybe we'll edge into AMV, I don't know. I think because there are lots of, you know, really good ads to talk about and a great story behind each one. You know, if it's okay with you, I'm really happy to take the time to really dig into this.
Oh, yeah, I'm in your hands. I've done, I did one between us. I did one at Wave last week with Tom McGilligan.
All right.
So I'm just so excited about that.
Yeah.
Basically, he hasn't talked to anyone for 25 years.
How did you get that to happen?
Because... a long story. Have you switched off your thing?
No, I'll switch it off now.
I'm not saying that for secrecy. I'm just saying so that it doesn't run through and then cause you a problem with files. But basically, I did that blog about him 2 years ago. Lots of members of his department got in touch and said, you know, like blog. And I said, if anybody knows where he is, let us know and I'll interview him. But nobody came forward. But they did say, if you find out where he is, we'd love to talk to him. He's disappeared. Nobody knows where he is. He was last spotted in Hawaii 10 years ago or something, blah, blah, blah. So nobody from all of his department seemed to know where he is. They all said, we don't know, but we'd love to talk to him. So then about 18 months afterwards, I got a call from a guy who said, oh, my dad said I should show you my portfolio, some American guy. So I said, oh, fine. So he came in. Son of Dean Hansen, who used to work with Tom and for Tom. anyway, we talked a bit about Tom McGallagher and Fallon McGallagher. I looked at his book and, you know, tried to help and wished him luck. And then about 6 months later, he emailed out of the blue and said, oh, my dad said, try this number. You might get Tom on it. Don't know whether it works. But so I was just about to call him. And then within that week, and then Pat Fallon died. And I thought, well, I can't really phone him now that Pat Fallon's died. It just feels like it's linked, or has that jogged my memory? So I just felt a bit bad phoning that week. And, you know, and it's obviously a weird time. I don't know what happened between them. But so I forgot about it again, but I'd written it down in my notebook. And then about 2 months ago or so, I tried it, partly expecting, you know, but given that he stopped because of alcohol, had an issue, and then also he's not talked to anyone that he's known, seemingly. So I expected some very aggressive, rude, miserable sort of person. Couldn't be more wrong. Most happy, chuckly, lovely person picks up the phone. And anyway, I ended up talking to him for quite a while. He was really nice, and then, you know, showed him some, you know, took him through some blogs and talked to him about stuff and said, love to do an interview. So eventually I recorded an interview with him the other day. But he said, look, I haven't talked to anyone for 25 years and I don't plan on talking to anyone else. So ask everything, ask anything.
No pressure.
No, so it was actually, funny enough, it was a little bit of pressure because A, I did it at Wave, and B, I was just conscious to not, you know, not step on his lines, not miss out any gaps, and not be a twat, you know. So anyway, but it was great. It was a really slightly weird thing, having written that thing 2 years ago, to end up talking to him. So,
wow, look forward to that.
Yeah, it should be good. So, I don't know. I'll probably get a few together and then do it. I don't know whether I could. I don't think I could do them as regularly as you do it. And also, I haven't got a theme tune. Have you written yourself that theme tune?
I just gave my son. Like, I said, can you just do something for my podcast, please? And he just sort of knocked that out in about 5 seconds with a sort of.
Did he really? Well, it sounds very professional.
Yeah, he's really good at the guitar, but he wasn't like, oh God, well, I'm going to, you know, plan this out and write something really. He just like
messed around with some blues. Okay. I'm going to carry on watching this cartoon.
That was it, basically.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thanks so much for this chat again. I think there's some fascinating stuff in there, and we'll have another chat about BNP in the near future.
Whenever you fancy. All right, cheers, Ben. All the best. Have a good day.
You too. Bye.
This is a podcast to watch Christmas.